Actually, I recognized Lynette immediately. She was the nurse who delivered me. It's a real pleasure to be with you here, and this is the second time I've been to St. Michael's. The first time was about 15 years ago, and at that time I came with a former law student and law clerk of mine, Michelle Bachman, who was at that time a state senator and later, of course, a congresswoman. But it's a pleasure to see a lot of people I know and to see the Quists and so many others. But I did have one person in particular that I did want to introduce for you here. And this is Dr. Phil Wold. Dr. Wold and I were in high school together at Sioux City East. He wasn't a doctor then. But he is now the vice chairman of the board of the Institute of Lutheran Theology. Phil, would you stand, please? As some of you may know, there is another rather well-known graduate, to you that is, of Sioux City East High School in Iowa, and that is your president, Dennis Harrison. But he was not a classmate of ours. He came much, much later and is much younger than we are. When we look to this question about preachers and politics and what does the IRS allow, I might just begin by saying that we are in a culture war today. And this culture war is dealing with spiritual issues, moral issues, cultural issues, issues in which we as a church certainly feel impelled to be involved. There is a very liberal law professor at Harvard, name is Mark Tushnet, and Professor Tushnet recently said, for liberals, the question now is how do we deal with the losers of the culture war? That's us. And he said, in my view, a hard line, you lost, deal with it, is better than accommodation. A hard line seemed to work quite well with the defeated Nazis in Germany after 1945. In other words, in his view, we are like conquered Nazis and are to be treated as such, and he and his liberal allies are like the Allied forces in World War II who are going to deal with us, but without a Marshall Plan. There is one of the presidential candidates who recently made the statement that the force of the law has to be brought to make change, and deep-seated religious beliefs will have to be changed. Now, in the interest of nonpartisanship, I am not going to identify which candidate, but that's what she said. As Lutherans, of course, we look to the issue of two kingdoms and see that God has ordained two kingdoms, that it's not that either kingdom is superior to the other, rather each kingdom has its own role in God's economy. Luther put it this way in his letter on secular authority. These two kingdoms must be sharply distinguished, and both be permitted to remain. The one to produce piety, the other to bring about external peace and prevent evil deeds. Neither is sufficient in the world without the other. Now, Luther's view of the two kingdoms is nothing like the ACLU's view of absolute separation of church and state. Luther would advocate a separation, but he would understand that the two kingdoms complement each other, that the state can do its job of preserving law and order and keeping our borders protected. It can do its job better if the church is doing its job properly of producing Christian citizens, people with good integrity and people who will make good citizens. I always say that Christians are the easiest people in the world to govern and the hardest people in the world to tyrannize if the church is doing its job properly. And the church can do its job better if the state is doing its job of keeping the streets safe and keeping the borders safe. And so church and state, properly understood, should complement one another. Well, when we get involved in the culture war as a church, though, we have to recognize that we are dealing with a tax code a code that deals with what we can and cannot say in this area. And we're talking about the provision in 501c3 of the Internal Revenue Code concerning tax-exempt organizations. And this code prohibits two things. And these two things, you can see in the outline, by the way, I'm using an outline. Does everybody here have an outline? I prefer to use an outline rather than a PowerPoint for four reasons. Number one, an outline is something you can take with you. Number two, an outline is something you can make notes on. Number three, with PowerPoint, you can get too wrapped up in the bells and whistles and miss the message. And number four, last and not least, I don't know how to use PowerPoint. But the two things that we are prohibited from doing are, number one, influencing legislation. And this is not a total prohibition, as we're going to see. That just can't be a substantial portion of your total activity. And number two, influencing elections. And that is a total prohibition, but we're going to see some limits as to under what circumstances and to whom that applies. Now, the history of this goes back to 1954, when President, well, Senator at that time, Lyndon Johnson, was running for re-election in Texas. Several tax-exempt conservative organizations were very critical of him, and when he narrowly won the election, he then proceeded to get the IRS code changed to provide for these limits, partly as a means of curtailing those who had been critical of him in the previous election. I have some serious questions about the constitutionality of it. I'll talk about those a little later. But let's just look to what 501c3 allows and doesn't allow. Now, before I do, there was a question that Lynette sent to me that some people have been raising concerning 501, or rather section 508c of the Internal Revenue Code, and this is being circulated to some circles and suggesting that this is our way out of 501c3. It's a way to get out of all the restrictions on this. Well, when I got the message, I was pretty sure I knew what this was talking about, but I did confer with Eric Stanley, who is the chief tax expert for the Alliance Defending Freedom. We had talked about this before, but I just wanted to make sure that we were in agreement on this. And basically, this provision simply says that churches, as distinct from other tax-exempt charitable organizations, but churches are automatically tax-exempt, meaning they don't have to file 501c3 status. They can, but they don't have to. Now, one possible advantage for a church in filing this status is that you will receive a determination letter from the IRS that says that you qualify as a 501c3 organization. Otherwise, it might have to be litigated at a later time. Also, it will establish that you are a church. Now, for most of us, I don't think that would be a problem, but if you're talking about churches, independent churches organized in homes and so on, there might be a question as to whether this Bible study has actually become a church, and the IRS has a 14-point formula here that they look at as guidelines to determine whether something like that really is a church or not. I looked at that one time, and it looked to me like the church in Acts would probably flunk about 11 of these 14 points. But at any rate, I'm not going to deal with that a great deal here. I'll simply say that while churches do not have to file for tax-exempt status, that doesn't mean they're exempt from the requirements of 501c3. In other words, even if you don't file under 501c3, to have tax-exempt status, it appears to Eric Stanley of ADF and to me as well, and we've talked about this at some length and we're in agreement on this, you still are required to keep these requirements here concerning influencing legislation and influencing elections. So this isn't your way of getting out of all the regulations like some people seem to be suggesting. Now, I might just add, as we move on to influencing legislation, we need to look to what is involved here and have some interesting questions that come up. I'm going to look at these point by point. First of all, what is legislation? And we would define legislation as action by a legislative body, such as Congress, such as a state legislature, such as a city council, a county commission. Now, a school board is a more specialized area, but a motion before a school board might still constitute influencing legislation. That's not quite clear, but at any rate, Here is, and I may add too, it also would involve something that is being enacted into law by the public. Like, let's say if your state allows for initiative or referendum, some states do, some states don't, participating in a legislative referendum, whether it's to get a law adopted, to get a law repealed, to get a constitutional amendment to your state constitution, participating in a referendum like that would be influencing legislation. Doesn't say you can't do it, just says that it can't be a substantial portion of your activity, and you're wondering what substantial is. We'll talk about that in just a little bit. Now, here's what is not influencing legislation, meaning you can do this to your heart's content as fully as you believe God has called you to do it. First would be calling for enforcement of current laws. If you believe that the laws that your community has on the books, dealing with pornography, for example, that these are good laws, but they're not being enforced properly, and you're wanting to come to the city council or write to the mayor or the police chief demanding that these laws be enforced, that's not influencing legislation. So that doesn't come under this prohibition. If you're criticizing Obergefell or another decision of the U.S. Supreme Court, again, that is not legislation, and that doesn't come within this prohibition at all. You can preach against the Supreme Court's decision in that area as fully as you believe God has called you to do. If we're talking about the appointment or the firing of a public official, if, let's say, your mayor has proposed to appoint somebody as police chief and you think this would be a bad choice or a good choice, to start a letter-writing campaign or call-in campaign and so on about this, again, that's not considered influencing legislation at all. Now, here is an area that is a little vague yet, and the IRS has not ruled on this yet, but what about a Supreme Court nominee or another federal judge? For them, of course, they are nominated, not appointed, by the president, subject to confirmation by the Senate. And if the president has nominated somebody for the court, and it's before the Senate for confirmation, whether Senate confirmation action constitutes legislation, my opinion is probably it does not. But that is a little unclear. So those are a few categories of things that would not be under that prohibition. Well, we've asked what is legislation. Now the question would be, what is influencing? Two things that we talk about in influencing legislation. One is direct lobbying, and the other is grassroots lobbying. Now, the difference between them is direct lobbying is if you are going directly to your congressman or your state legislator or whoever we're talking about here, urging that person to vote for or vote against a certain bill, that's direct lobbying. If you are urging other people to do so, like if you're encouraging your church members to write your legislator and speak out against this, or you write a letter to the editor encouraging the public to do so, that is grassroots or indirect lobbying. Either of those does constitute influencing legislation, and again, doesn't mean you can't do it. It only means that it can't be a substantial portion of your total activity. Now, here is what is not influencing. One is a broad discussion of the issues of the day. If you have an informational meeting where people are just asked to come and ask questions and talk about this particular bill, that would probably not be considered influencing legislation, especially if you're not making a specific recommendation. Informational activity is not considered influencing legislation. Now, informational activity is normally, if you present kind of an informative, let's say scholarly type paper that cites sources and just is designed to give information about a topic, even though you might include recommendations in that paper, just presenting that informational activity is not influencing legislation. Now, there is obviously a gray area between informational activity and what the IRS calls carrying on propaganda. The difference is this. Anything that I write is informational activity. Anything my opponents write is propaganda. And you're laughing, and I am too here, because obviously there's a lot of gray area here, but a lot of it has to do with tone. If you present the different alternatives and present them fairly and objectively, even though you may come up with some conclusions at the end, that will probably be considered informational activity. Third category is what's called technical advice. Let's say if it's an issue on which you have some particular expertise, particularly if it's an issue in which a legislator has asked you to come and testify before his committee about it. Now, just to make sure you're covered, you could ask the legislators, any possibility I can get you to issue me a subpoena? And that will make it even more clear you're there at their request, not simply because you have decided you want to try to change their minds on something. But if it's an issue in which you might have some particular knowledge, let's say if it's a question about eliminating the parsonage allowance, and you might want to come in and testify about this, explaining what the practical effect on a pastor and on a church of eliminating the parsonage allowance would be. That you probably know some things about that. You probably know how many pastors might have to leave the ministry because their parsonage is no longer covered and so on. How many churches no longer provide parsonages but rather give a parsonage allowance instead. That might be an area where your technical expertise would be of value to legislators. And so that's another category that is exempt. Another that could be related to that, and that is the self-defense option. If there is a proposal before Congress to eliminate 501c3 and say churches are and charities are no longer tax exempt at all, you can devote as much of your time and effort as you wish to fighting that. You can devote 100% of your activity to it, although I probably wouldn't recommend that. But if it's self-defense, in other words, something that directly impacts your ministry, let's say you had a regular ministry of going to the state park. I know one of our Free Lutheran churches that I speak for in Ohio occasionally, they have, in the summer months, they have a service out of the state park. Now, if the state of Ohio were to pass a law saying no one can conduct a church service in any of our state parks, well, that would directly impact your ministry. And you could come in and fight that, and that would not come under the lobbying restriction whatsoever. And finally, and this is vague, because the IRS has been vague on this so far, if you send out a mailing that goes only to your members, and it concerns a legislative issue that is of special interest to your church, not necessarily an issue that directly impacts your church, but that you know is of interest to your people, such as maybe abortion, if it just informs them that, hey, there's a bill before the legislature that would make abortion mandatory for all pregnancies or something like this, and does not encourage any specific action, that's not going to be considered influencing legislation, even though that might be its practical effect. Well, we've looked at what constitutes legislation. We've looked at what constitutes influencing. Now, what constitutes substantial? And when we see that term in the Internal Revenue Code there, we wonder, how are they going to define this? Well, you'd be amazed at the definition. And the definition, obviously, is won by some bureaucrat somewhere. But the definition of substantial, as you can see it, in the code itself, is more than insubstantial. I don't know if anybody ought to ask them to define insubstantial or not, because if they did, I think they'd probably say less than substantial. Now, that sounds like a lot of bureaucraties, doesn't it? But there might be some wisdom in what they're doing, and probably they have defined it that way simply because they don't want to be tied down to a specific formula, which gives the potential for abuse as well. But very possibly they've defined it in that way simply so that they have some leeway to deal with the situation. Even though the IRS has said on numerous occasions, we are not going to be tied to specific percentages, the general view among attorneys who deal in this area is that if your activities are probably 5% or less, if that's less than 5% of your total activity, whether we measure that by your total budget, total man hours, the total time committed to it, or total floor space committed to it, 5% or less, you're almost certainly okay. 5 to 15, maybe somewhat questionable. I'd say probably under 10, you're probably going to be okay. Anything more than probably 20%, and if the IRS were to take a look at you, you could possibly be in some difficulty. Anyway, again, that's vague, and I think the IRS has deliberately left it that way. All right, so those are some of the ramifications of the provision that says that you cannot devote a substantial portion of your activity toward influencing legislation. Now we'll go to the other part that we're prohibited from, and I'm on page 3 of the outline here, but the other part concerns supporting or opposing candidates. Now, on this, we don't have any substantiality issue. This is a total prohibition. But we're going to see that there are some cases in which it doesn't apply, and I'll talk about those in just a moment. This is something you can't do at all, influencing legislation. And what would constitute, elections. But participation in a campaign for or against candidates, whether it's by going out to work for that candidate, contributing to that candidate, again, I'm talking about the church, not the pastor, not the members. But anyway, participating in the campaign, contributing to the candidate as a church or to a political action committee supporting the candidate, public statements made by the church, or public endorsements by the church, not by the pastor, but by the church, or in other ways, directly intervening in a campaign, these things would constitute influencing an election. Now, what is an election? Well, we look at several things that qualify as elections here, but pretty much anything for which the public, that is the voters of the nation or the state or the county or the city or the district, where they are voting for somebody who is going to hold a public office. It would include elections for county commission, for county officers, for school board, for state legislators, state offices, members of Congress, the president. All of these would be included here. And it'd apply whether you elect your mayor on a partisan basis or a nonpartisan basis. It would apply to judicial elections as well if you live in a state where your judges are elected. And for some of you, like Iowa, where they're not actually elected, but they are, come up for a vote yes or no on retention every 6 years, I would say a vote of yes or no on retention would probably constitute influencing an election, even though the name is just on the ballot, shall he be retained, yes or no, and there's no opponent listed. I would say that would probably also constitute an election. Appointed offices are not included here. Again, if your governor is going to appoint somebody to a particular office and you are strongly in favor or strongly opposed to that, a letter-writing campaign against that appointment is not influencing an election, and so no problem on that. Now, here are some things that do not constitute campaigning for office. One is conducting a voter registration drive. And I might add, you might be amazed at how many church-going Christians are not registered to vote. And many of them don't even realize if you're not registered to vote, you don't get to vote. But conducting a voter registration drive in your church, provided it's nonpartisan, even if you happen to know that the vast majority of those that you're going to get registered are going to be voting for one candidate rather than another, no problem there. A candidate debate forum is fine. If you have the candidates come to answer questions in your church, that is just fine, provided you've made the invitation to all of the candidates for that particular office. And it doesn't matter that some of them may turn down the invitation. They had their opportunity. Having campaign literature in your church, that would be all right, again, provided that any candidate for that office, at least, that wants to leave literature is free to do so. Again, it wouldn't matter that some of them may not do so. Now, the issue about voter guides, and we know that a number of organizations produce voter guides, and this is important. We want to know whether the person we're considering voting for is in agreement with our position on issues like abortion and other issues that are important to us. And so sometimes these voter guides consist of how did this candidate vote on the issue and showing his key votes there. Sometimes they will just be a questionnaire to the candidates asking how do you stand on these questions. And it's all right to distribute this to the members of your congregation, provided they're not comparing the church's position to the candidate's position and not making a specific recommendation as to whether you should vote for that candidate or not. Now, I have to say that in this whole area of voter guides, the IRS rules, and even they don't even have rules, actually, but pronouncements they've made and determination letters on this have been vague. And so what I've said here is open to a lot of question. They're vague on it. They seem to be just moving towards saying more now, you're free to have these voter guides provided that they're not urging a specific vote. Now, if after listing all of these candidates' votes, you conclude this candidate voted 90% conservative or 10% conservative and so on, probably okay. The IRS has said in the past that that might not be okay, but it's the way they've been looking at that lately. So long as you're not making a specific recommendation, you're probably okay on that. I just ask you to realize that this is a gray area right now. I was speaking to a group of Lutheran pastors in Mobile, Alabama, several weeks ago on this subject, and one of them asked me the question, well, what if I want to put a Trump sign on the lawn of my parsonage? And my answer at the time was, I think that's going to be okay, and as I thought about it, I'm really 90%+ sure that's okay. Again, that's assuming the parsonage is owned by the church. If it's owned by you personally, definitely there's no problem on that. Well, again, I conferred on this with Eric Stanley of Alliance Defending Freedom, and he's of the same view. So long as it's clear it's on the lawn of the parsonage and not on the lawn of the church, that parsonage is going to be considered, I'm virtually certain, as your personal space. And not only that, but your family's personal space as well. And so shouldn't be any limits at all to what kind of signs or other things you want to do on your parsonage. If you want to have your parsonage available for a meeting of the campaign staff of a candidate, shouldn't be any problem at all if it's the parsonage and not the church building. Not a problem in the church either, provided that it's available to people of all denominations, or not of all denominations, of all parties who are running. And as far as giving a candidate the church's mailing list, you can have your own policy on that. Again, the IRS position seems to be no problem there, provided you give it on an equal basis to every candidate who asks. If you sell it, that's one thing. If you just give it to everybody, that's one thing. The thing I would suggest to any candidate is interested in this, find somebody in the church who already has a directory and ask them if you could have it. And if a particular member of your church chooses to share the directory, that's totally outside your control. Just like if somebody comes in your church parking lot to distribute flyers, put flyers on windshields and so on. I guess if some candidate came to ask me if they could do that in my church, I'd say don't ask. In other words, I'm not going to say you can, I'm not going to say you can't, just don't ask. And that way you wouldn't be in this issue of whether or not you're showing favoritism to one candidate or another. Now, what happens if you violate these restrictions? Well, the penalties listed here are very technical. One thing they can do is they can revoke your tax-exempt status. As to them doing so, it's not very likely, but it can happen. Now, in the 62 years since the Johnson Amendment was adopted, do you know how many churches have actually lost their tax-exempt status for political participation? Actually, zero. Somewhere between zero and one-half, maybe. There was one fairly large church that put a full-page ad in a newspaper saying that voting for Bill Clinton would be a sin. I agree with that, but that clearly is influencing legislation. There was a complaint. The IRS looked into it and made a few threats. The IRS ended up just simply withdrawing the determination letter that they had sent determining that this church was a 501c tax-exempt organization, but they didn't actually revoke the tax-exempt status there. Many times, if this is a one-time violation, they will simply call it what they say is a de minimis violation, and they'll just kind of let you off with a reprimand and say, don't do it again. Now, the likelihood that you're not going to get caught on this, whether that should influence what you do, you're going to have to decide that for yourself. Now, let me just mention another thing here, and I've already said that the rules I've just mentioned here apply to the church, not to the members, not to the pastor. Now, what if you as a pastor want to get involved? What if you as a pastor want to write a letter to the editor and sign it with your name saying that I, Lyndon Corinan, endorse Bernie Sanders for president? You're not going to do that, I know, but no problem whatsoever. What if he signs it, Lyndon Corinan, pastor, Cokato Lutheran Church? Again, no problem. But if he does it this way, Lyndon Corinan, on behalf of the board and members of Cokato Lutheran Church, then we brought in the church's action, not just his, and then it would become a violation. In other words, if he just simply uses his own name, no problem. If he mentions his status as a pastor to give him some additional credibility, no problem. If he mentions that I'm pastor of this church to establish that, yes, I do have some clout, that's no problem. But it is as if he, when he comes to speak for the church itself, that's when we have a problem. And what about endorsing from the pulpit? The IRS has generally said, and I've just heard them say this in seminars that I've been to, but that is not allowed. But there might be even a question there. I recall a seminar that I attended in Atlanta some years ago, and they mentioned a black pastor in Atlanta who had wanted to endorse Jesse Jackson. And he told his congregation, you know, I wanted to endorse Jesse Jackson, but I'm not allowed to do that from the pulpit. And so he stepped out of the pulpit and said, I endorse Jesse Jackson. Well, everybody laughed at that, but I think that pastor might have been a lot wiser than they were thinking. If by that symbolic gesture of stepping outside the pulpit, he was demonstrating that he was speaking for himself and not for the church, if that ever got litigated, I think he'd be okay. Anyway, so those are a few things that you as a pastor can do, and again, the church cannot donate to a candidate. Individuals within the church can, the pastor can. We already talked about the membership list and a few things like that. I'll just simply add a couple of things here. First of all, it is my personal opinion that this restriction is a free speech and free exercise and establishment clause violation. Free speech because it's a chilling effect upon you and what you can do and say in the pulpit, even though you believe you are saying this not because you happen to be interested in politics, but I would trust that if you are speaking out on a matter like this, you are doing so because you are convinced that God has called you to do so. And so it is a restriction, I believe, on free speech. It is a restriction on free exercise of religion. I would also say it is a violation of the Establishment Clause, because the way the Establishment Clause has been interpreted, you cannot have government doing any action that would advance some religions and inhibit others. Now let's say that in your church, you believe that God has called you to take a stand on certain issues. Let's say that the pastor of the church across the street does not believe God has called him to take any stand like that at all. And as a result, if the IRS code is enforced, your church does not have tax-exempt status, but the church across the street does. And a person then who's considering, what church should I attend? Well, let's see, if I attend this church, my contributions are tax-exempt. If I attend this church, they are not. I think I'll go to the one where my contributions are exempt. In other words, I think one of the effects of this provision of the code is that it advances those religions that don't feel called upon to take a stand in these areas and inhibits those who do. But there is no provision, no court decision yet that has so ruled, And that's despite the fact that the Alliance Defending Freedom has been trying to get a ruling like that for some time. Now, here's what ADF is doing on this. They, in September of every year, they've had for about probably 10 years now what they call Pulpit Freedom Sunday. What they mean by that is that they call upon pastors to commit themselves that they will preach a sermon that would endorse a candidate or in otherwise be contrary to what the IRS requires. That they will send a copy of that sermon to the Internal Revenue Service, and that they will send a copy of that sermon to the Alliance Defending Freedom. And if the IRS comes after you, ADF says, we will provide you with a legal defense at no expense whatsoever to you. Now, the first time ADF did that, about 10 years ago, they had some 78 pastors that signed up. Every year since that time, the number has increased to where now it's well over 1,000 each year. Out of all of these, any guess how many the IRS has come after? Zero. In other words, I think they may be afraid that they would lose a challenge on this, and so maybe they're deliberately backing off on this. Now, as to whether or not you would like to do that, that, of course, has to be between you and your congregation and, of course, the Lord. But a couple things that I would say about it. First of all, question would be, am I disobeying the law? And if so, do I have a right to do that? And I will say, first of all, I don't know where Lutherans ever got the idea that we owe absolute obedience to the state. It certainly isn't from Scripture, and it certainly isn't from Luther. In fact, the Augsburg Confession says that we obey government, except when government commands what God's word forbids, or forbids what God's word commands, in which case we must obey God rather than man. Obviously quoting from Acts 5:29. And you consider Luther himself, well, there was an act of interposition against the emperor that saved Luther's ministry. You remember after the Diet of Worms, when he refused to recant, and he was declared to be an outlaw and a heretic, and anyone who found him was commanded to capture or slay him. And you recall what the Elector Frederick did. He simply staged a mock kidnapping, took Luther into hiding, gave him the moniker of Knight George, and kept him safe up there in Wartburg Castle, where during the next year he translated the New Testament into German. That was clearly an act in defiance of central authority, an act that I would describe not as civil disobedience, but as interposition. And that is what saved Luther's ministry at the time. And I don't recall Luther say, oh, no, we can't do that. I've got to obey the... No, Luther never said anything like that at all. Now, Luther's position on a question like this was, he took him a while to come to a position of understanding interposition, but by 1539, his position had solidified. And here's what he wrote at that time. Our princes have therefore decided that in such case, his imperial majesty is not an emperor, but a warrior, servant, and robber of the pope, as the latter to make in such a war is the real leader and emperor. This is the attitude of our estates, that is the northern princes. The German princes have more right against the emperor than the people in that day had against Saul, and Ahikam against Jehoiakim. The emperor is not an autocrat, and it is not within his authority to depose the electoral princes and change the form and glory of the emperor, and it is not to be permitted should he attempt it. Inasmuch as this could not and dare not be permitted in any way, as affecting business matters and temporal affairs, how much less is it to be endured if his imperial majesty begin and wage war for a foreign cause and in the interests of the devil? If his majesty does not know that the cause is so evil, it is nevertheless sufficient for us that we know it and are certain of it. And Calvin came to this conclusion a lot quicker than Luther did. But Calvin had the benefit of 25 years of Luther's development of thought. By the way, I have discovered, contrary to what the historians say, there was one instance in which Luther and Calvin met. On that occasion, Calvin said, Brother Martin, I have read your 95 theses. Luther said, well, what did you think of them? And Calvin said, you nailed it. I don't think that'll make its way into the history books. Maybe the joke books. Anyway, secondly, I would say that if you were to do this, you are not engaged in civil disobedience or in interposition. If you were to preach a sermon like this, you are not in violation of the law. And let me choose my words very carefully. You are engaging in activity that might put you outside the protection of 501c3. But you are not disobeying the law. You are not committing a crime. But whether you choose to do that or not is, of course, between you, your congregation, and the Lord. Well, I had some things that you can see here that I might suggest that you consider having in your bylaws, but you can look at those, and I might add that the Alliance Defending Freedom on their website has a booklet that you can download, Protecting Your Ministry, that gives you much greater detail on this. I might just add also, for those of you that might live in western Minnesota or in South Dakota or might like to drive, that I will be speaking on this subject, a six-hour seminar at the Institute of Lutheran Theology in Brookings next Saturday from 9 to 3 p.m. And anyway, I have some brochures on my book table out there that tell about that if any of you would care to come. We have about 5 minutes before I'm supposed to close, so do we have some questions? Yes, ma'am. Before President Johnson was able to get that limit passed, there was no restriction whatsoever on what 501c3 organizations could preach about. You were free to preach about politics and elections and legislation as much as you and your congregation and the Lord thought you should. There was no limit whatsoever before that. Good question. Others? Go ahead, sir. Al Quist, good. Okay, the question is, are church-related schools or any religious institution, are they affected in the same way? I would say, first of all, yes, because they are, assuming they're 501c3 organizations, the answer would have to be yes. But there's also a matter of academic freedom within the institution that obviously you're going to be having professors and students and others who are engaged in all sorts of advocacy. But it'd be a question whether the school itself is officially taking a position on something. So I would say the same restriction would apply equally, but it would be, as far as the activity going on in the classrooms and things like that, I would say it probably applied differently because of that. Others? By the way, Al Quist has been a friend of mine for many, many years. His wife managed Michelle Bachmann's congressional office for many years, as well as the Senate office too, I think, didn't she? Didn't you? And anyway, he will be speaking later in the day. He's at Bethany College in Mankato. And anyway, he is very, very much worth hearing. Yes, sir. The question he is asking is about state civil rights commissions, and they're saying that because churches are public accommodations and calling them public accommodations because the public is invited to attend the services, that therefore they're under various state equal opportunity requirements and things that a church might do, like having separate bathrooms for men and women, or such as refusing to have same-sex marriages on the premises, things like this, that these could be considered to create a hostile environment and therefore a civil rights violation. Now, the only state I know of that has attempted to do that so far is the Iowa Civil Rights Commission. Is that the one you're thinking of? Massachusetts as well? Okay. But in Iowa, I know there are two churches, Cornerstone Bible Church in Sioux City, and which is represented by the Liberty Institute on this issue, and Fort Des Moines Church of Christ, which is represented by the Alliance Defending Freedom. And both of those are challenging this, and as I believe I read that the Civil Rights Commission of Iowa had decided to back off somewhat on this. Scott, do you know more about that?
Yeah, they backed off, but then they did also take it to court for a hearing, and the judge just ruled this past week that that the government cannot determine what is a religious activity within the church, and therefore they're free to keep the restrictions.
That is, you mean the Civil Rights Commission is entitled to keep its restrictions, or the church is entitled?
The church can have them.
Good. Okay. Good. And I have recently decided to come out of the closet because I think I am actually a dog trapped in a human body, and so I'm demanding all sorts of accommodations. And but that is, I mean, this is so silly because it is so totally subjective. Anybody can make any such claim. And there's no way of objectively verifying or falsifying it, and it can be changed anytime the individual wants to change it. Well, it's almost 1:25, so do we have one more question before we close? Yes, sir.
Do you foresee that this Johnson ruling will, in the near future, be overturned?
That really will depend a great deal on who is on the Supreme Court and who makes those appointments, and who is going to be in the Senate to confirm those appointments. So with the current, I mean, the court, I don't think has been as divided as it is today since at least the 1930s and maybe before, with four liberal members of the court, three conservative members of the court, and one who is kind of in between, maybe leaning slightly conservative. But depending on who makes the next appointments, I think that could really decide that issue. And of course, it might be some time before the issue is ever brought before the court, because really before anybody's going to be able to raise this, the IRS is going to have to take action against somebody, and I think they've been a little wary about doing so. And of course, there's also been a bill in Congress, there's been a bill each session for several decades now that would eliminate the Johnson Amendment, and if that bill should pass, as I hope it does, then that would eliminate it that way. One more, okay?
Hank? Where do executive orders stand in relation to legislation?
Okay, I'll just give you a quick answer on that, because that's really a little bit outside that. I would say that the matter of executive orders, that really there have been executive orders since the days of George Washington, and you can't really run a government without them. What is wrong is when the executive orders go outside what the powers delegated to the president are. For example, if the president has power in certain areas given by the Constitution, he could certainly make regulations and issue orders in that area. But when we have, for example, on the immigration issue, where the president several years ago asked Congress to pass an amnesty bill, told them, I can't do this, this has to be done by you, Congress refused to do so, so he proceeded to issue an executive order, although we called it an executive memoranda, that did exactly what he had just told Congress a year earlier he didn't have authority to do. Well, that clearly is an executive usurping the function of a legislature. In that case, a federal court in Texas ruled that the president's action was unconstitutional. The circuit court, Fifth Circuit, upheld that ruling. It went to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court split 4-4 on it, which meant that on a tie vote, the lower court ruling was upheld, but without as much precedential value. So that's where we are on that right now. But yes, I'm concerned about executive orders too, but you need to distinguish between those that are authorized by the Constitution and those that go beyond it. Well, with that, I know that we have somewhere to go this afternoon, and so I really enjoy the opportunity to be with you. I'll be here through the rest of the day. I have to leave tomorrow morning for a speaking engagement in Atlanta. And by the way, I've just been in D.C. for the last 2 weeks, so this is the culmination of quite a long trip. But anyway, I'll be glad to visit with you this afternoon and evening as long as we possibly can. Thank you, and God bless all of you.